Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now! Today, a Labor Day special.
The person who called me was unlike most of the workers who called. He wasn't from Mississippi or Louisiana. He wasn't either white, black, or Latino. He was an Indian man flown in from India, calling from the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I thought, what was an Indian man doing coming here to clean up after Hurricane Katrina?
We'll speak to longtime immigrant labor organizer Saket Soni about how immigrant workers have been lured to the United States and trapped in forced labor to rebuild communities after climate disasters. Then we'll go to Salvadoran poet and writer Javier Zamora, author of the best-selling memoir Solito. As a 9-year-old boy, he traveled alone 4,000 miles to reach the United States.
From 7, 8, and 9, I knew that I wanted to be reunited with my parents. What kid doesn't want to be and wake up next to his parents? And so I didn't really understand how I was going to get here or how dangerous it was for me to travel the 4,000 miles that I did. But what I did know is that I loved my parents and I really, really, really wanted to be with them.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. Today, a Labor Day special. As the rate of climate-fueled disasters intensifies, we begin today's show looking at how immigrant workers have been lured into forced labor by corporations that hire them to clean up after hurricanes, floods, blizzards, and wildfires. This is what longtime labor organizer Saket Soni writes about in his new book, The Great Escape: A True Story of Forced Labor and Immigrant Dreams in America. I talked to Saket Soni earlier this year and asked him to take us back to 2006, when he received a mysterious call from inside a heavily guarded work camp in Pascagoula, Mississippi, where hundreds of welders and pipe fitters had been recruited from India to come to the Gulf Coast to repair oil rigs after Hurricane Katrina.
Thanks, Amy. That's right. It started with a mysterious midnight phone call after Hurricane Katrina. I was a labor organizer running a scrappy small workers' rights nonprofit. And this was a time when the post-Katrina flooding had turned the U.S. Gulf Coast into the world's largest construction site. I was protecting the workers who were doing the cleanup and the rebuilding. Most of these were black and brown workers who would stand in the morning under a giant 60-foot-tall statue of Robert E. Lee when contractors would pick them up and take them out to do the rebuilding of the distant dark corners of the Gulf Coast. That's what I was doing. Those are the workers I was talking to when I got the mysterious phone call. The person who called me was unlike most of the workers who called. He wasn't from Mississippi or Louisiana. He wasn't either white, black, or Latino. He was an Indian man flown in from India calling from the Mississippi Gulf Coast. And I thought, what was an Indian man doing coming here to clean up after Hurricane Katrina all the way from North India? I discovered that he was one of 500 workers who had been recruited to come to Mississippi and Texas to work for a large oil rig builder to clean up, rebuild shipyards and oil rigs. And when he arrived in the Gulf Coast, he found himself in atrocious conditions. These men had been promised green cards and good jobs in India and had been told that they would get those if they paid $20,000 apiece. $20,000. I mean, that is generations of savings. Workers sold ancestral land. They took on extraordinary loans from violent loan sharks to come. But when they arrived, they found themselves not on green cards, but on temporary work visas in labor camps in company property.
And talk about the security on the company property, not exactly security for them, but for the company Signal that still exists, right?
Well, the company Signal International decided to build a labor camp on company property. This was a series of trailers that were placed on a toxic waste dump. The workers were living there, 24 people to a trailer. The labor camp, which the company itself called a man camp facility, was surrounded by a barbed wire fence. Workers were working round the clock in 12-hour shifts to build these oil rigs for the company. This was a private equity-owned rising behemoth in the Gulf Coast, Signal International. And they were getting these workers, the most skilled workers in the world, at a fraction of the cost of U.S. workers. There were security guards. The men were only allowed out of the labor camp, chaperoned by American security guards. And the places they were allowed to go to were Walmarts, where they would buy provisions to come back. That's how the workers lived. Those were the living conditions.
What about the food?
The food was atrocious, atrocious. The workers were given most mornings stale bread and frozen rice. There were no microwaves, Amy, on the worksite, so the way the men would eat the frozen rice would be to suck on it. The men would suck on frozen ricicles in order to gain the sustenance to do their really difficult and dangerous work. In fact, the whole Great Escape, the escape out of a heist film that's at the center of the book, was actually imagined and engineered over a series of clandestine meetings that featured food. I started partnering with a man deep inside the labor camp, a worker named Rajan, someone who is he was a labor organizer's dream. He was extraordinary. He taught me about the pressures on the men. He taught me about the conditions at the labor camp. But he also taught me to cook. And over a series of months, I would smuggle into him spices and ingredients to create Indian food. He commandeered the kitchen in the labor camp. And through a series of magical meals, he brought the men back to life from their catatonic state. And he convinced them then to undertake the Great Escape at the center of the book. I don't want to give too much away, but it involved...
Oh, you have to. Saket, you have to tell us the story of what happened.
Well, it involved bribes for the guards involving wild turkey whiskey, flavored cigars. And Rajan and I created an elaborate pretext, a fictitious Indian wedding to ferry the men out of the labor camp, five at a time, under the noses of the guards, to put them on the path of a freedom journey. The men escaped overnight from the labor camp, came back the next morning, threw their hard hats in protest back at the company's gates, saying that they were leaving the company. And then they set off on a march to Washington. What we didn't know then was that there was an agent deep in the government who was unraveling our plans. But we set off that heady morning for Washington, thinking that justice was at hand.
And take it from there. Can you tell us the journey that they took?
Sure. Well, when the men escaped from the labor camp, they filed a civil lawsuit against the company. But the path to legal status for them was a Department of Justice human trafficking complaint. Human trafficking is a crime, and the men were alleging that this company and their recruiters had trafficked them from India to Mississippi and Texas and held them in forced labor. The men were counting on the Department of Justice opening an investigation. We now had, I personally now had the problem of hiding 500 brown men in Louisiana. So we hid out in a hotel in New Orleans that had been ruined by Hurricane Katrina, flooded by Hurricane Katrina. We hid for over a week, but there was radio silence from the DOJ. So we set out, like many people in social movements past, we decided to come out of hiding and come out as undocumented to the government. And we proceeded on a march to Washington. Along the way, we met with civil rights figures who gave us strength. And although the men had it hard, I mean, we were walking on the sides of roads through Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. Passing cars were full of passengers who were jeering us. Bottles were being pelted at the workers from open windows and passing cars. But nonetheless, the men's spirits were high because they believed that when they got to Washington, they would get justice. In their particular English, they actually called it the Department for Justice. And they believed they would just get to Washington and they would get the status that they deserved, the special humanitarian visas designated for trafficking victims. What we didn't know was that the fight would take 3 years, because deep inside the government, there was a federal agent, an immigration cop, with his own corrupt ties to the company and with his own secret motivations to unravel our plans. On our way to Washington, we uncovered surveillance and we uncovered a whole federal dragnet that was working its own machinations to jail and deport these men even before they got to Washington.
So, Saket, you have to stop there, because what are you talking about? There's someone in the Justice Department who has a tie to Signal Corporation?
Not in the Justice Department, but at the federal immigration agency called Immigration and Customs Enforcement. There's an ICE. Immigration cop who lives, ICE, who lives in Mississippi, who has his own motivations for colluding with the company. So now that the workers are on their march and headed to Washington, he appoints himself as the investigator for the DOJ. When the Department of Justice launches an investigation, they bring in a law enforcement official to investigate. We've been waiting at this point in the story for ICE to bring in the FBI. We did get a call from the FBI, but after that, they were nowhere to be found. When the investigation actually did start, an ICE agent came forward to tell us he was in charge of the investigation. And again, I don't want to give a lot away, but this very ICE agent had his own ties to the company, had been working with the company for years and years, and now was in charge of the investigation. What he was doing, though, Amy, was, we'd find out later, wasn't investigating the workers. He was turning the investigation into a weapon against the workers. He was trying to frame the men we were representing, the 500 Indian workers, as the criminals, and working to jail and deport them.
And so this is not just a story of a corporation that is exploiting, that is, to say the least, not just terrorizing, but deeply abusing these workers. But it's a story of corporate government complicity. Talk more about what the government knew, what the government did and didn't know along the way.
Well, you know, in the right at the middle of the story, there's this smoking gun that we find. It's the astonishing revelation of a long-standing collusion between Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE police, and the company. And it really gets at, Amy, what we see all the time. I've seen this for years and years in my work as a labor organizer after disasters and also across the South, which is that companies have at their behest cops who moonlight as private security, immigration agents who work deeply with the company to keep workers feeling like they can't come forward and report abuse because they might be deported, they might be punished. In this story, when a few brave workers came forward to meet with me clandestinely, and after that, these brave workers demanded things from the company, not anything major. Their demands were hot tea in the morning, because they'd get up in the morning in the cold and need to warm themselves to go to work. They demanded microwaves on site so that they could warm up their frozen rice. These were their collective demands. I mean, it is a sad day in 21st century America when workers have to press collective demands, not for union rights, respect, and a contract, but for microwaves on site in their labor camp on company property to warm up their rice. Those were their demands. And for making those demands, the company worked with law enforcement agencies to punish the workers. And that was the details of that revelation were ultimately what blew all this up in Washington. And I tell that story in The Great Escape.
And talk about what happened when the workers and you, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of workers who escaped from a Mississippi labor camp there to clean up after Hurricane Katrina, and then they make their way to Washington. What happens there?
Well, one of the things that happens is we're coming out of a civil rights memorial on the way to Washington. And we look up and we see a man surveilling us. We see a man recording us. There's a chase scene that's recounted in the book, up to the top of the building, around the block, and all the way to a parked, what looks like a parked construction van, a contractor's van. I thought it was, you know, some kind of self-appointed white vigilante operation, and flung open the doors of the van. Inside it was the Alabama director of ICE conducting a surveillance operation. So, you know, that was when it came to light that the ICE dragnet was surveilling us. As we got to Washington, we realized that the conspiracy between the government and the company went deeper and deeper. It wasn't just one or two ICE agents, but a whole network of law enforcement officials that surveilled us all over again in Falls Church in Virginia, right as we were going into Washington. So, you know, what we were very clear about coming into Washington was Washington wouldn't be easy. D.C. would be a fight. When the campaign hit the rocks in D.C., my partner, Rajan, and I, over an elaborate meal, came up with the next escalation. Rajan cooked we had become close friends. Every friendship has its rituals. We never solve problems over a whiteboard. We solve problems over extraordinary meals. And one night that's recounted in the book, Rajan cooked an elaborate, mysterious Bedouin dish called al-kabza. It has rice, meat, and 22 spices. And we came up with a plan over that meal for a hunger strike in Washington, D.C. And that was the next step. I recount the story in the book about a long hunger strike over the course of which all of Washington is talking about these workers. But the ICE agent blocking our plans holds steadfast. So even in D.C., even with the world watching, even with the Department of Justice investigating, the company and its allies in law enforcement were still strong enough to hold back our justice march and keep the workers undocumented and on a pathway to being deported.
So, Saket Soni, in this remarkable story that you tell, The Great Escape, you bring us back to 2005, Hurricane Katrina, the cleanup. But 2005 is a few years after the 9/11 attacks, 2001. Can you talk about what happened with ICE, with DHS, the anti-immigrant fervor in this country, and then what these guest worker programs are all about?
Well, 9/11 was a very pivotal moment for America. It was a tragic event, but followed after that by multiple other tragedies. One of the impacts of 9/11 was that immigrants lost their foothold in normal American life. Immigrants like me, I came to the United States as a foreign student before 9/11. I was actually in Chicago. I arrived from New Delhi to Chicago to study at the University of Chicago. I was getting a theater degree. My parents were probably the only parents in the history of Indian civilization who said it was okay for their son to go to America to become a theater director. And that's what happened. That's what I was doing when I missed an immigration deadline. That was before 9/11. So I just took it as a routine thing, something I could fix. I didn't think it was more serious than an unreturned library book. And I have a lot of those. And then 9/11 happened. And I lost my foothold in America, like lots and lots of immigrants. We were underground, working without papers, doing our best through a string of low-wage service sector jobs. 9/11 was also a pivotal moment for immigration policy. Immigrant rights activists were really close to immigration reform and a large-scale legalization before 9/11. Those plans were gutted after 9/11 because of the anti-immigrant backlash that was not connected to the perpetrators and motivations behind 9/11, but came from an opportunism in American politics to congeal an anti-immigrant sentiment in America, a sentiment that only grew after that. So 9/11 was a really, really great turning point.
As you publish this book now, we're right on the end of the catastrophes that California is experiencing. Your book, takes place in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, which many see as the dawn of the era of climate disasters. But can you talk about the connection between what happened then right through to now and what you're looking at with, to say the least, the knowledge and organizing you have behind you?
Absolutely. What I didn't know then, Amy, was that these workers who came from India were among the first workers that would be a rising workforce, workers who we now call the resilience workforce, the workers who largely immigrant, largely undocumented, mostly vulnerable, the workers who rebuild after climate disasters, the workers who continue to clean up, repair, heal, and rebuild after hurricanes, floods, and fires. The workers who I represented after Hurricane Katrina, the workers who would, gather under the statue of Robert E. Lee in New Orleans, or workers like the ones in this book who were in labor camps, were among the first resilience workers. Katrina was supposed to have been a once-in-a-hundred-year flood. That's what it was called, an event that would not happen for another 100 years. Well, since Katrina, as a result of climate change, disasters have become more frequent and more destructive. There have been, since Katrina, over $200 billion disasters. And as disasters have grown, this workforce has grown. And these workers do all this without legal protections, without legal status. They often have to fight to be paid. And if they fall off roofs, they're often left at the doorstep of hospitals for dead. This is how we're doing recovery in America. And that's what we at Resilience Force are trying to change.
Saket Soni, the director of Resilience Force and the author of The Great Escape, a true story of forced labor and immigrant dreams in America. Coming up, we'll speak to the Salvadoran poet and writer Javier Zamora, author of the best-selling memoir Solito. As a 9-year-old boy, he traveled alone 4,000 miles to reach the United States. Stay with us.
Don't you work yourself to death. Take a break from the man-made to catch a breath to.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Javier Zamora. He's a Salvadoran poet and writer whose New York Times best-selling memoir, Solito, tells the story of his own odyssey to the United States as a 9-year-old boy from Salvador across Guatemala, Mexico, eventually through the Sonoran Desert. He traveled unaccompanied by his family, by boat, by bus, and by foot. After a coyote abandoned his group in Oaxaca, Mexico, Javier made it to Arizona with help from other migrants. I asked him to talk about where he was born in El Salvador and how he ended up coming to the United States.
Well, I was born in 1990 in the small fishing rural village of El Salvador called La Herradura. And, you know, I was born during wartime. And because of the Salvadoran Civil War that started in 1980 and in 1992, my dad fled in 1991. The war ended, but the war didn't end at the same time. So my mom left my country in 1995. And I was left at the care.
I'm only interrupting for a moment, because before you take us on that journey, if you could expand more on when you said your father left. You're talking about a country where the U.S. backed the military in Salvador, well known for killing thousands of Salvadorans. Can you give us a picture of what that U.S. policy meant? Because I think that is what is so absent from so many discussions as people now try to make their way to the United States.
You know, at one point, only Israel was getting more money than El Salvador in the 80s, and we're talking millions of dollars a day. And before the U.S. got involved, the left was winning. And what the left wanted was equality, women's rights, and education. And because of those asks, my dad was a leftist, and he was the head of a co-op. One of his older brothers was disappeared by the military in 1980, and the violence was everywhere. And because of those reasons and because of his ideological leanings, he had to flee in 1991. And same with my mom. You know, it is still difficult in my country in 2023 and also in this country being a woman. There's a lot of gender-based violence. And because of, you know, you were talking a lot about sexual assault, and that is everywhere. And that was a huge reason why my mom also fled the country.
And so you were, what, 1 year old?
I was one when my dad left, and I was five when my mother left.
Being raised then by your grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about them deciding for you to take this journey and how you traveled?
You know, the moment that my dad left, he would we would communicate via letters and phone calls. When my mom left, it was the same thing. And what they both